Christianity. Not every church makes this point through the ritual of the Eucharist. Some do so through more ecstatic means, like the Pentecostal service that made me uncomfortable when I was a teenager, and others do so through music and hymns or public prayer. It can, however, be difficult to give public thanks. In liturgical churches, the Eucharist is often seen as private, an act in which individuals go forward in a single line or kneel at an altar in a sort of spiritual cocoon, not so much to delight in the generosity of God as to beg for forgiveness for their personal sins. Here, the Eucharist is less about receiving than it is about penitential pleading. In that Pentecostal service, the preacher had to call people out to give thanks. I have worshipped in many traditional churches where the public prayers were full of requests for healing and justice. But when the pastor asked for thanksgivings, an eerie silence filled the sanctuary. Even though gratitude is the heart of faith, Christians seem to have a hard time getting there, at least in public. About a decade ago, journalist Kathleen Falsani sought an interview with her favorite poet, Nobel laureate Seamus Heaney. She wanted to ask him about spirituality, but Heaney, who was born a Catholic in Protestant Northern Ireland, was reluctant to address the subject. He had drifted away from his childhood Irish Catholicism, but his poetry reveals a grounded soul with a keen awareness of the sacred. Falsani was curious as to what he thought about faith. Heaney declined to answer, saying that he was woefully inarticulate when it came to discussing such matters. However, he did something else. He replied by sending her a poem, one that spoke to his sense of spirit and that revealed the Eucharist as gift and gratitude. Like everybody else, I bowed my head during the consecration of the bread and wine, lifted my eyes to the raised host and raised chalice, believed, whatever it means, that a change occurred. I went to the altar rails and received the mystery on my tongue, returned to my place, shut my eyes fast, made an act of thanksgiving, opened my eyes, and felt time starting up again. Even when one leaves church behind, the Eucharist remains, always holding out the mystery of gift. Life and joy for all. Receive and give thanks. The world made new. Political exuberance. Having been to political conventions, I can testify that they are theaters of play and communal exuberance. There is nothing else quite like the balloon drop when a favorite candidate secures a presidential bid, when emotions overflow and hopes run high with dreams of victory. Politics is another arena where we experience communal gratitude. But there it gets a lot more complicated. On January 20th, 2009, I was speaking at a conference on St. Simon's Island in Georgia. St. Simon's is beautiful, but I was distressed about being away from my home outside of Washington. My house was full of guests, friends, and relatives attending President Obama's inauguration, and I was not there. The conference attracted mostly progressive Christians and had been scheduled long before Barack Obama's historic election. We were meeting at a conference center that did not have televisions in all the rooms, and I suspected that many would be disappointed to miss the inauguration. So I asked the organizers if they could stream the event live into the massive auditorium where we gathered for the keynote speeches. They seemed reluctant. The vast majority of the 800 attendees, one leader admitted, surely supported the new president, but there would be a few who did not vote for him and might be offended. I pressed on, however, and the other speaker joined in my request. Thus, on Inauguration Day, I watched President Obama take the oath of office with several hundred liberal Southerners. There was a lot of crying and cheering. We knew we stood on slave ground, not far from a spot where some slave cabins still survived. Most of those at the conference grew up during segregation, and some had worked for civil rights throughout the South. For them, watching a black man become president was cathartic. Many commented how grateful they were that we could be together to celebrate and how much they appreciated sharing the emotions and excitement in community. Even though we were far from Washington, we made our own inauguration party right there on the watery shores of the old Confederacy. Some of the organizing team, however, did not seem entirely happy with me for having made the request. I imagine they heard from the attendees who did not support the new president. One person pointedly refused to speak to me for the rest of the event. I felt terrible for the rest of the week. It was, in a word, awkward. The moral of the story? One person's ecstatic celebration can be another person's greatest fear. When politics comes into the mix, things get dicey. In the United States, we live in a time when it is easier to celebrate a baseball team from another city than it is to celebrate a presidential inauguration. There is a reason for this, one that is quite important to how and where we celebrate together. In the case of a sports team, we are usually celebrating something more than just winning. Other than the people in Chicago who wanted to win, Americans celebrated the Cubs because they had been losers, and they became a jaw-dropping great baseball team. We cheered their story, their history, their talent. We were thankful that even some who were unlucky for 100 years could rise above it and achieve their dream. We loved their story. And unless you were a die-hard Cleveland Indians fan, you could be grateful for it. On St. Simon's, I'm sure there were some conservatives who thought we liberals were thankful that we won and they lost, that we were celebrating a winner in order to kick a loser. I was not thinking about winning or losing. I was grateful for a story, a long American story, about race and oppression that seemed to be coming to an end in January 2009. With the election of a black president. It was like cheering the Cubs. It was not that the Republicans lost. It was the overwhelming beauty of the achievement itself and the new possibilities for America's future. Political gratitude, however, is rarely about the beauty of the thing. It is too often about partisan power and control. Mary Jo Leddy explains it this way. If we tend to imagine power as a pie, either very big or very little, then we tend to think in terms of some having more and others less. One person's gain is another's loss, where dissatisfaction reigns supreme as it does in our culture. Then the scene is set for a conflict over the pie. Only the whole pie will suffice. Nothing else will satisfy. Thus, the kinds of celebrations that result from pie-grabbing breed resentment, the exact opposite of communal gratitude. Although a political rally might be the cause for thanks for true believers, those outside the circle see such an event as an insult or threat. If political events focus on a single individual, like a candidate or a head of state, they can easily become authoritarian spectacles rather than true communal celebrations. It is very easy to turn partisan exuberance into manipulation, even violence. The test of any political event is its result. Does the communal celebration bring out good civic character or ill? who appears, the better angels of our nature or the demons within? An inauguration is not intended to be a partisan rally. It is intended to be a festival of thanksgiving for democracy and the nonviolent transfer of power. It is meant to celebrate a process and a people and give thanks for a land. That intent has been lost, perhaps because it was a bit of a myth in the first place, or perhaps because our practice of politics has become more malevolent in recent years. Leti's remark should haunt us. Where dissatisfaction reigns supreme. The fact that we have lost the binding power of civic festivity is disturbing. Ingratitude is a perpetual state of dissatisfaction. Ingratitude is about what we do not have, what we feel we deserve, what we can never get, or what keeps us from our rightful part of the pie. Ingratitude and genuine civic festivity are deadly enemies. If we cannot play together, if we are not thankful in the common arena, we cannot be a good team. Public ingratitude threatens rather than invites, isolates rather than unites. As a result, we lose the experience of shared communal joy. Psychologists have demonstrated that feeling grateful is good for the heart, that gratitude strengthens health and well-being. If this is true for individuals, it is true for communities and countries as well. To feel grateful together moves us from me and my political opinions toward we and the good of our community. Communal gratitude might heal our civic heart, putting us on a path toward a new future of national emotional health and well-being. We, that is, those of us in divided, discouraged, and dissatisfied Western societies, could use a big-scale gratitude intervention, not in the form of some solemn scold, but in the guise of a global street party. Times are difficult, yes, but we have so much to be grateful for. Our lives really are surrounded by gifts. We need to let loose in thanks. According to Barbara Ehrenreich, instead of partisan rallies in our politics, we are in need of more civic festivals. The capacity for collective joy is encoded into us almost as deeply as the capacity for the erotic love of one human for another. We can live without it, as most of us do, but only at the risk of succumbing to the solitary nightmare of depression. Why not reclaim our distinctively human heritage as creatures who can generate their own ecstatic pleasures out of music, color, feasting, and dance? Why not? Why not rediscover gratitude through play? Thanksgiving. So how can we reclaim gratitude in our communal settings? If gratitude is contagious, it is our duty to spread it. Perhaps it starts by attending a local sporting event, a citywide festival, or a block party celebrating summer. More than anything else, though, I want to reclaim Thanksgiving as our major festival of gratefulness. In the United States, Thanksgiving currently suffers from two major problems. It is relegated to the status of a private family celebration, and it serves as the commercial kickoff for Christmas. Other than providing us with a day off from work, a public holiday, and engendering a few civic proclamations, ignored by most, Thanksgiving has largely moved from the public sphere to the domestic one. Generally, we celebrate in intimate groups, typically family, in our own homes with our own feasts and watch games on our own televisions. Some of the privatization has emerged, no doubt, because of a certain awkwardness associated with the holiday. The picture of happy natives feeding grateful pilgrims just does not square with the historical record. Nor do the nostalgic Norman Rockwell images of a patriarch overseeing a happy nuclear family at a table fit with the experiences of most American families today. Without a larger sense of story, and not knowing how to move past the myths we once lived by, we retreat into our private spheres and make the best of a day off, and stuff ourselves with turkey. With regard to the second problem, today Thanksgiving in America is lost in the consumerist rush to Christmas. Not so long ago, stores closed in a grateful pause that allowed shoppers and sellers to breathe before the December holiday. Now, however, you get a couple hours to gobble down the meal with the relatives before you rush out for holiday discounts. Huge crowds gather not to play, but to be the first in line at Walmart. This is not the ecstasy of gratitude. It is the agony of scarcity. Instead of giving thanks for abundance, we push to the front of the queue to make sure we get ours before anyone else beats us to it. Consumer Thanksgiving is more a zero-sum game than a celebration of bounty. Advertisers remind us that supplies are limited. In what has become an orgy of "I'll get mine," often someone dies in the struggle for a must-have toy or cheap smartphone. But Thanksgiving is still there, no matter how ignored, privatized, or corrupted it may be. There are parades, which need not be commercials for Christmas, feasts, some of which are provided by service groups and religious communities, and sports. If the surveys are right, that 80% of us experience gratitude on a regular basis, why not celebrate that? Gratitude evidently is something we share. We might even give thanks for the binding power of thanks. Gratefulness is not partisan, exclusive, or even necessarily religious. Indeed, one of my favorite Thanksgiving blessings comes from Adam Lee, an atheist. As we come together to share this meal, let us first remember how it came to us and be thankful to the people who made it possible. This food was born from the bounty of the earth, in warm sunlight, rich earth, and cool rain. May it nourish us in body and mind, and provide us with the things that are good for living. We are grateful to those who cultivated it, those who harvested it, those who brought it to us, and those who prepared it. May its consumption bring about the pleasures of friendship, love, and good company. And as we partake of this food in each other's company, as what was once separate from all of us becomes part of each of us, may we also remember what we have in common and what brings us all together. May this sharing of food foster peace and understanding among us. May it bring us to the recognition that we depend on each other for all the good we can ever hope to receive, and that all the good we can hope to accomplish rests in helping others in turn. May it remind us that as we reach out to others to brighten their lives, so are our lives brightened in turn. These words also serve to remind us what we can celebrate together. Food, the bounty of the earth, the gifts of life and work, the pleasure of relationships, the real unity of community, peace and interdependence, and a call to serve others as we have been served. We celebrate a day when we can turn history on its head and say that Thanksgiving is not about colonists taking from native peoples, but about the abundance of a beautiful land, a land bountiful enough for all, that it is a day marking humility, forgiveness, and appreciation. These things are worth celebrating. Heck, they are worth shouting from rooftops, singing about, and whooping it up in the streets. Not only does the American Thanksgiving need renewal, Thanksgiving needs to go global. The world does not need just an American Thanksgiving or a Canadian Thanksgiving or a Japanese Thanksgiving or any number of other national Thanksgiving days. The whole planet could use a day to say thank you. Maybe on September 21st, World Gratitude Day, which was started in Hawaii in 1965 and has since been adopted by the United Nations, but is not yet universally celebrated. It is a great idea, one that is growing, and certainly one whose time has come. Thanksgiving, everywhere, should have fireworks, bands, street parties and games, football, soccer, basketball, what have you. It should not be just a day on a calendar, but a genuine global festival. Let prayers and benedictions from Christians, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, Wiccans, humanists, agnostics, and atheists sound. Thank you. Let's have a great big global celebration to recognize the gift of life we share, to respond with humble thanks, and to recommit ourselves to serve nature and neighbor. Let it be a day of gratitude from every corner of the earth. Let's inaugurate that. Part 4. We Ethics. Community and Politics. If you're grateful, you're not fearful. And if you're not fearful, you're not violent. If you're grateful, you act out of a sense of enough, and not a sense of scarcity, and you are willing to share. If you are grateful, you are enjoying the differences between people, and you are respectful to everybody, and that changes this power pyramid under which we live. David Stendhal Rast. Chapter 7. The Grateful Society. May we not keep our blessings, but give them away. Tom M. Schumann. On January 21st, 2017, I woke early and got ready to take the metro from my home in Northern Virginia to downtown Washington, D.C. For months, a single word had blocked out the day before on my calendar. Inauguration. My daughter and I had planned to celebrate Hillary Clinton's becoming America's first female president. Instead, because of a sad and unexpected election result, we stayed home on Inauguration Day. One day later, and alone because my daughter went back to college, I journeyed into the city for an alternative event, the Women's March. My husband dropped me off at the subway station nearest our house, something he does for me on a fairly regular basis. "Wow, look at all those buses," he exclaimed, as he pointed to a convoy of charters with North Carolina license plates. "And look at that line," I replied, directing his attention toward the entrance, where more than 100 people waited. "I've never seen so many people here." "I wonder if it is like this at every stop," he said. "It's so early. It doesn't even start for hours. Could be a big day. I bet this will be something." He pulled up to the Kiss and Ride and, dutifully obeying the sign, pecked me on the cheek. "Have fun. Call me when you want to be picked up." I hopped out, took a bright fuchsia crocheted hat from my coat pocket, put it on my head, and joined a group of women who were carrying signs and wearing identical headgear. With the exception of the pink hats and protest signs, the metro car resembled a scene from Rush Hour at the Tokyo subway. On the train, there was barely a place to stand. When we disembarked at L'Enfant Plaza, thousands coursed through the station. I had arranged to meet some friends, mostly clergywomen, in front of the National Museum of the American Indian. Although the crowd was already larger than any I had ever seen, and it would grow into one of the largest protest gatherings in history, I arrived first at the meetup location. The patio was already jammed with marchers. I worried that my friends would not find me, as I was just one pink hat among thousands. I looked around and realized that the museum had placed huge boulders around its entrance, as I suspected, both a landscape design and security feature. I scrambled up on the rocks. From there, I could both survey the crowd and be seen. I waited. Standing on the boulders eventually worked. Across the growing crowd, hands waved in recognition. My friends navigated through the throng to the rocks. There was no place to stand on the patio, so they joined me on the artificial mount and the concrete bench at its base. We greeted one another with hugs and tears. Finally, one said, "We brought the signs." She passed them out to the dozen or so of us who made up this small Christian band, with our pink hats, ordination stoles, and clergy collars. A few other women who were pastors saw us and joined the party. She gave them signs too. I looked at the placard she handed me, a piece of black cardboard with rounded white letters that read, "Blessed are the poor, Matthew 5. The Beatitudes. Our signs were Jesus' words from the Sermon on the Mount in the New Testament. I laughed as I read them all. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the hungry. Not only were there signs bearing the actual words from the Bible, but my friends had added a few special updated Beatitudes for the day. Blessed are the women. Blessed are the uninsured. Blessed are the immigrants. Blessed are the LGBTQ. We were marching with the Beatitudes. Or not. Because we were stuck. The crowd had so filled in that it was difficult to move, much less march. We stayed up on the rocks, wearing pink hats and clerical collars and holding up blessings, as women slowly filed by below. "Yay! Blessed are the poor!" a voice shouted from the crowd. "I'm mourning a lot right now," yelled another. "I must be really blessed." And more replies. "God bless the immigrants! Jesus welcomes everybody! Blessed are the protesters! Even politicians would be blessed if they pass single-payer health insurance. Blessed are the working mothers." Some pointed at the signs, commenting, "Look, the church is here." Who knew that Christians would show up at a march like this? Others seemed surprised to see clergy. "Blessed are the women preachers." And surprised by the presence of collared women, more than a few marchers stopped to talk and pray. My mind wandered back to the New Testament, to an ancient hillside in Galilee, where Jesus had stood just above the crowds and uttered these blessings for the first time. Looking out at the poor, the weak, the oppressed, women and slaves, he preached his radical Sermon on the Mount, proclaiming the promise of a new society. Although the words were so familiar to me because I had heard them all my life, when I stood up on the rocks in the middle of the women's march, I realized that Jesus' sermon added up to one thing. "Blessed are all of you who are disregarded by the powerful, for you are God's beloved community." Jesus blessed history's losers. No wonder people all those years ago had listened. No wonder they remembered and wrote it down. No wonder it is still so powerful 2 millennia later. The blessings were protest against injustice. I looked down from the artificial hillside, and my heart moved as I watched the crowds. I held my sign up higher and shouted, "Blessed are the poor!" Some women yelled back, "Blessed are the poor!" And others cheered. Yes, they cheered the Beatitudes. And tears came. The day before, I had cried because I was afraid and sad. But on this day, I cried because of blessings. For the first time in 2 months, I felt grateful. Gratitude is an emotion we experience as individuals, and we can each practice gratitude as a personal ethic, the foundation of a good life. Yet gratitude is inherently social. It always connects us as individuals to others. Communal gratitude looks and feels wonderful when festivity, play, and ecstasy draw us together. Just as personal gratefulness comprises both emotions and ethics, so does communal gratitude. The grateful feeling community can and should lead to a grateful society. Feeling grateful is not only play, but it can be a form of politics. Gratitude is joy, and gratitude is justice. True gratitude, real gratefulness, the kind of transformative thanksgiving that makes all things new, cannot be quiet in the face of injustice. If we embrace the sort of gratitude that changes our individual lives, it will revolutionize our political lives as well. We move from a personal ethic of gratefulness toward a public one. The me of gratitude must extend to the we of gratitude as an ethic, a vision of community based on habits and practices of grace and gifts, of cultivating a wide field of vision and deepening our awareness of humility and blessing, of setting tables and sharing food for all. Gratitude is not merely resilience. Gratitude is resistance, too. It is time for all of us to join the resistance. Blessed community. As I experienced that day at the Women's March, blessings and gratitude are intimately connected. Few of us are naturally thankful for things that appear to curse us. We give thanks for friends, health, provision, and love. Blessings. We are blessed. We are grateful. But what are blessings? The English noun blessing means gift from God and is derived from the verb to bless, to hallow, or make holy. Eventually, bless became associated with bliss, meaning merriment, happiness, and favor. Thus, blessing came to be used in two senses, both as a sacred gift and something that makes one happy. Gifts and gratitude are always of a piece. Blessings and thanks go together. The Beatitudes, however, can be confusing. Few give thanks for poverty, hunger, or grief, as Jesus did in his sermon. Most contemporary people have a very different idea of what makes for a blessed life. Blessed are the rich, for they own the best stuff. Blessed are the sexy and glamorous, for everyone desires them. Blessed are the powerful, for they shall control the kingdoms of the earth. Blessed are those who get everything they ever wanted. They alone will be satisfied. Blessed are the famous, for their reward is eternal life. Money, beauty, power, achievement, and fame. We hold these things in esteem. If only we had them, or just one of them, we would be blessed. We have forgotten the meaning of the word, identifying it with mostly material things and consumer goods. The Greek word for blessing ascribed to Jesus in the Beatitudes is makarios, which means both happiness and favor. A few Bible translations actually replace blessed with happy, reading, happy are the poor, happy are the hungry. To understand blessings as mere happiness, however, often results in a strange view of blessings. It seems to say poverty or starvation is a gift, and we should be happy to have it. The alternate sense, however, opens up a new understanding of the relationship between blessing and gratitude. Blessing is not just happiness, but favor. In the Christian scriptures, the word specifically means God's favor, often called grace or abundance. Favored are the poor, or gifted are the poor, would be equally valid ways of making sense of Makarios. The sense of the Beatitudes is not, if you are poor, God will bless you, as a sort of consolation prize. Or, if you do nice things for the poor, God will bless you. Nor is it, be happy for poverty. Instead, blessed are the poor could be read, God privileges the poor. If you are poor, you are favored by God. God's gifts are with you. This would have shocked Jesus' hearers on that day long ago. Blessing was beyond the reach of everyday people. The blessed in Greek actually became interchangeable with the gods and the elite and meant something like those worthy of honor. Thus, the blessed were the big shots of the ancient world, the upper crust, those who lived above all the worries of normal existence. The poor, the losers, had to live with shame. Even back then, the blessed were the rich, not the poor. In the Roman Empire, the world in which the Beatitudes were first preached, people believed that the emperor was uniquely blessed, and all blessings flowed through him, the one worthy of honor to everyone else. The richer and more powerful you were, the more valor and virtue you possessed, the closer you were to the emperor at the top of the social hierarchy. The more blessed you were, the more blessings you could, if you chose to, bestow on those beneath you. When Jesus said, "Blessed are the poor," he overturned the politics of blessing. He preached that blessings were more than happiness. They were a social vision. God gives gifts to everyone, but especially to the vulnerable and those at the bottom of society. Gifts are not only for the few, but widely distributed for all. And the people at the bottom? The losers? God's favor resides with them. God has uniquely blessed them. What is the proper response to gifts? Gratitude. Blessing is an invitation to give thanks. We also get something else wrong about blessing. We tend to think of it as directed to individuals. In this amazing sermon about blessings, however, Jesus addressed a crowd. Of his 9 blessings, 7 are plural, they and theirs, and only 2 are singular. Jesus was more concerned about a blessed community than blessing people one by one. This is not about my blessings, but about ours. At the end of the sermon, Matthew reports, "Now when Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were astounded at his teaching." I bet they were thankful too, for a blessed community is a grateful community. They started as a crowd, and the way opened for them to become a society formed by gratitude. Haunted by Rome. Through human history, gratitude has been built into society. We human beings do things for others who do things for us. Reciprocity, claims Jonathan Haidt, is a deep instinct. It is the basic currency of social life. Doing favors and repaying favors, the most foundational definition of gratitude, forms the core of familial, tribal, and political relationships, forging connections of trust, debt, cooperation, and connection through large groups of people. In other words, gratitude is indelibly communal. Communities are not just random groupings. They are the purposeful forms that organize human life and work. We structure community around ideas of power, protection, production, and obligation, often linking those things with cosmology and religion. Gratitude is not, therefore, a free-floating emotion or ethic. It exists within these communal structures, and our experience of gratitude is profoundly influenced by social and political arrangements. Although more than 1,500 years have passed since its end, the structures of the ancient Roman Empire still haunt Western societies. This is especially true in relation to gratitude. Politically, Rome was a hierarchical pyramid, with the emperor on top as its focal point of unity and faith. He was the ultimate benefactor of the Roman world, the very model of generosity, justice, provision, and civic welfare. Everything good descended from him to the lower ranks of people, nobles, soldiers, citizens, merchants, peasants, foreigners, conquered peoples, and finally slaves. If you had food, it was because of Rome's largesse, embodied by the emperor. If you owned land, it was because Rome gave it to you. If you were happy, it was because Rome offered peace. A system of gifts and tribute, a structure of patronage, held Rome together. The emperor bestowed gifts, and all his beneficiaries returned their gratitude in the form of taxes, tithes, tributes, honor, loyalty, public works, and return favors. Gratitude was not merely warm feeling toward the benefactor, writes historical theologian Peter Leithart, but reciprocal service and benefaction. Benefits imposed a debt on the recipient that had to be discharged through a return of service or benefit. This hierarchical structure of gratitude, with its required reciprocity, was the glue of ancient Roman society and politics. Since economic benefits flowed down, the members of each social class took a share for themselves and left less for the classes below. By the time benefits reached the bottom rung of society, they were paltry and thinly distributed. Yet the lower down you were in the social structure, the less you received, but the more you owed to those above you. Gifts flowed down. Gratitude repayment flowed upward. In the same way that members of each social class skimmed benefits flowing down, they also took their share of tribute and taxes as payback made its way back up the pyramid. In order for the emperor to receive his proper portion and everyone to take theirs, taxes were inordinately high on the poor. In contemporary terms, gratitude's payback was regressive and often created huge financial debts for the lower classes. Debts of gratitude were monetary debts, not only social ones. The poorer you were, the more you were required to return to your benefactors. In this system, ingratitude was a political and economic act. To refuse to pay or return a favor was treason. The Roman philosopher Seneca insisted that nothing was more harmful to society than not being grateful. Ingratitude was the cardinal social and political sin in the Greco-Roman world. Ancient Romans could not imagine an empire without gratitude. But their idea of gratitude, of repayment for imperial favor, was embedded in the structure of their politics. Obligatory reciprocity was the fabric of society. Gratitude was not a feeling. It was a political requirement. Even after the fall of the Roman Empire, this structure continued in the form of medieval feudalism. It developed into a complex system of quid pro quo, tit for tat. I do this for you, you do that for me. With devastating social consequences involving everything from destructive land practices and unjust laws to wars of insult and personal revenge. Europeans struggled with the ghost of Roman benefaction for centuries. In the 17th and 18th centuries, new options emerged, however, as philosophers and politicians imagined a new system of contracts and chosen obligations in politics and business. They banished gratitude to the private sphere of domestic relations. Instead of order through benefactions and tributes, public life would be governed by covenants, contracts, democratic process, and the rule of law. Gratitude was thus pushed into the domestic sphere where it flourished. Given the chance, women reshaped gratitude as a structure of emotions, relationships, and manners. Elaborate, yes, and with pitfalls, surely. But women subverted the hierarchical structure of gratitude and turned it toward virtues of love and festivity. In the male-dominated public sphere, however, patronage and payback kept sneaking back in, mostly through business. Eventually, commercial interests overtook democratic ideals of civic life, and business brought with it brokers, patrons, deal-makers, and tit-for-tat arrangements. As corporate interests grew, gratitude mutated into lobbying, a profession based on obligatory reciprocity. By the 21st century, political action committees manipulate politics by treating politicians as their clients and bestowing largesse in return for favorable policies. Anyone who breaks rank with the patron is punished by the withdrawal of favor, that is, political cash. For all intents and purposes, the structure of public gratitude that bedevils our society today resembles that of ancient Rome. Although we have not seen it clearly, we are now living through a renewed conflict over gratitude and politics. The question is surprisingly stark. Will gratitude be used to undergird hierarchies of power and quid pro quo that benefit the few? Or will gratefulness undo unjust practices of control to enlarge the circle of benefits for all? The choice we make could not be more important for the future of our life together. Women take on gratitude. At the end of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, Lady Catherine de Bourgh confronts Elizabeth Bennet, the novel's heroine. Throughout the story, Lady Catherine has used her wealth to reward those who obey her and to punish those who do not, controlling the lives of all those who depend upon her patronage. Lady Catherine is also the aunt of Mr. Darcy, whom Elizabeth had once believed haughty, but whom she now loves. A rumor that Darcy and lower status Elizabeth will soon be wed reached Lady Catherine. Outraged that her nephew might enter into such a match, she confronts Miss Bennet to find the truth of the matter. She demands that no engagement take place. Elizabeth will not confirm the rumor, because it is not true. But she also refuses to submit to Lady Catherine's demands. If I am that choice, why may I not accept him? Lady Catherine flies into a rage, saying that such a marriage would be a disgrace, and calling Elizabeth an obstinate, headstrong girl whose undesirable family connections would make a mockery of Mr. Darcy's high birth and force him from polite society. She predicts terrible consequences if Elizabeth marries Darcy, consequences that Lady Catherine herself will help bring about. She attempts to intimidate Elizabeth by pointing out her inferior birth and maintaining that she is of no importance in the world. Lady Catherine accuses Elizabeth of ingratitude, since she had previously welcomed the young woman to her own table. Is there nothing due me on that score? Elizabeth is resolute. She will not promise to refuse an offer of marriage. A furious Lady Catherine finishes her tirade. You refuse, then, to oblige me? You refuse to obey the claims of duty, honor, and gratitude. You are determined to ruin him in the opinion of all his friends and make him the contempt of the world. Elizabeth replies, neither duty nor honor nor gratitude has any possible claim on me in the present instance. If Mr. Darcy asks, Elizabeth will say yes. Lady Catherine cuts her off. I take no leave of you, Miss Bennet. I send no compliments to your mother. You deserve no such attention. I am seriously displeased. Jane Austen's novels often portray conflicts between different structures of gratitude. In Pride and Prejudice, Lady Catherine embodies public gratitude that reflects duties of benefit and obligation, a world where gratitude is a transaction in a hierarchical society. Austen sharply criticized that form of gratitude, showing Lady Catherine as cruelly vengeful, using her status to vindictively assert her superiority. And that is the problem with gratitude in politics, the problem that 18th century people experienced and tried to reform. In transactional gratitude, there are often punitive ramifications for beneficiaries, while privilege on the benefactor side continues to assert control, and neither of those things is good for society. Gratitude and the power play. Both the punitive and privileged aspects of gratitude are still on full display. Jane Austen's Lady Catherine de Bourgh is not just a character in a novel. Indeed, her specter haunted the 2016 American election for president in the dual ghosts of these two sides of transactional gratitude, a lens few have thought to employ in analyzing recent political events. Gratitude as punitive. During the Democratic primary in the spring, a story broke that Hillary Clinton had received a large fee from Goldman Sachs for giving a speech a few years earlier. This story, in addition to news that the Clinton Foundation had received cash from foreign governments, caused a firestorm. Senator Bernie Sanders demanded to see Mrs. Clinton's Goldman Sachs speech. He wanted to know what she had said to Wall Street's wealthiest executives. He believed that the money they had paid her, as well as money donated to her campaign, made her indebted to these benefactors to carry out whatever policies they wanted. You're not going to have a government that represents all of us, Senator Sanders insisted, so long as you have candidates like Secretary Clinton being dependent on big money interests. Dependent. Hillary Clinton was the beneficiary, not the benefactor. This meant she owed a debt of gratitude towards those who had given the money and was in some way obligated to enact policies favorable to them. Few people understood this in terms of benefactors, benefit, and beneficiary, That is the transactional structure of gratitude. Many assumed that such big benefits come with big strings of return favors attached. In this scenario, benefit is nearly indistinguishable from bribe. With bribe comes payback. Certainly no one gives a gift of hundreds of thousands of dollars without expecting something in return, or withholding future benefit if appropriate gratitude is not forthcoming. If you are on the receiving end of this transaction, you may expect the benefactor to come after you. Essentially, Bernie Sanders wondered if Hillary Clinton would, or even could, be a free political agent. Would she be in thrall to big donors? And if she did act independently, would the donors penalize her, or the country, for not doing what they wanted? I suspect that many people, especially given how many people eventually voted for Clinton, thought all this a ginned-up political distraction. Few, however, thought about these actions in relation to gratitude, but they really were. Although it was not presented well in the media, some people feared that benefactor, benefit, and beneficiary were locked together in a dangerous social arrangement. If anyone suggested that Clinton might actually be a benefactor, her family does run a large charitable foundation after all, such a suggestion was hard to hear. Instead, Hillary Clinton would forever be a recipient at the bottom of the gratitude cycle, always threatened by malevolent patrons, as Lady Catherine said, a disgrace, the contempt of the world. Is it ever appropriate to elect a president who is a beneficiary subject to the whims of reward and revenge of unscrupulous givers? Or was this all a manufactured political attack? Perhaps. But the questions at the core of the episode are old ones indeed. Questions about how gratitude, power, and obligation work in a good society. Gratitude as privilege. Donald Trump was born to a wealthy family, inherited a fortune, and made even more money in his own business empire. Trump depicted himself at the top of the economic pyramid, a successful self-made businessman who dispensed favors to others instead of receiving them from others. He depicted himself as the ultimate benefactor. He told this story in The Art of the Deal, a peculiar cross between a memoir and a self-help book. Even a quick perusal of it reveals a man who sees the world as a stage for quid pro quo. Life is a deal, in which a confident winner gets other people to do what he wants and makes a lot of money while doing it. The Art of the Deal is a riff on the ancient idea of noblesse oblige, the notion that the rich are obligated by their social standing to take care of those beneath them. Noblesse oblige has, in principle, fueled much charitable giving and social good, but it is based on privilege, and that the greatest benefactors come from the upper classes. Throughout the presidential campaign, Trump made claims of giving magnificent gifts to nonprofits and charities. He also insisted that because he was among the world's wealthiest businessmen, he was not beholden to favors. His wealth insulated him from paybacks to benefactors because he did not need anything. By self-funding my campaign, I am not controlled by my donors, special interests, or lobbyists. I am only working for the people of the U.S. Although noblesse oblige was always a concept of privilege, it could be practiced in selfless or benevolent ways. For Trump, however, noblesse oblige is about winners and power. Privilege functions primarily as an economic and political tool as he said in this exchange in a 2015 Republican debate. Trump: I will tell you that our system is broken. I gave to many people. Before this, before 2 months ago, I was a businessman.